Hi, this is Nadine Dietz, host of CMO Moves. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thanks so much for stopping by today and to give you a quick overview on what to expect. CMO Moves is all about game-changing leaders, their incredible journeys, the moves that they've made, and most importantly, their personal stories of how they got to be the leaders of some of the world's most exciting brands. I hope you'll enjoy their stories as much as I do and take away a few tips and some inspiration for your day. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to CMO Moves. Today we are bringing you the fourth installment of a very important conversation that needs to be had across every community, across every country. But in particular today, we are talking with Asian Americans, particularly East and Southeast Asians who live in the United States, who have been subject to increased racism and hate due to COVID. Now, this is our fourth installment, and we were delighted to welcome back Cynthia Chen, who was part of our first installment, which was the D&I Summit. And she was our moderator today. She is the president of Consumer Health North America at RB. And with her are nine incredible leaders from TikTok to General Mills to Google to Pinterest to Visible to Pixly. It's just a packed agenda. And we are so honored and delighted that everyone joined us today to share how they were feeling, how they are leading, and how we can all take steps towards systemic change together. Now, if you missed our first three installments, please check them out, starting with the D&I Summit, which led to a state of revolt, followed by Pride Stars. Coming up, we're going to be featuring a summit dedicated to Hispanics and Latinx, as well as people with disabilities and South Asians. Thank you for being part of this important conversation and have a super day.
Hello there and welcome to the Asian American Summit hosted by Adweek. I'm Ko Im, community editor and podcast co-host of Adweek. I am an American. I am an Asian American. I'm also a proud 1.5 generation Asian Pacific American. Before we get started, we want to also point to a few other discussions that are coming up. We have the Hispanic Latinx Summit in August, as well as one for people with disabilities. Today's summit now is one of a series of deep conversations we've been holding around diversity and inclusion. Today, we focus on the Asian American community. Today is another chance to get real and get actionable. Today, we hear from illustrious Asian American leaders in our industry. They represent a diverse group in our country. Asian Americans make up 20 million of the US populations. Our families come from over 20 countries. Some of our ancestors worked on the railroads or plantations that helped build this country and fuel the economy. And no, we are not going back to where we came from. We are the fastest growing racial group in the US electorate currently. According to Pew Research, we've since surpassed Hispanics as the largest share of recent immigrants. Some of us are high income earners and highly educated, but that's not all of us. We are not a monolith and we are not a stereotype. Further, the model minority myth painting Asian Americans as meek, law-abiding, hardworking persons of color perpetuates the silencing and dismissal of this powerful demographic and the wide range and validity of our experience. When we were all put on pause during the pandemic, some of us stayed quiet as we braced for a rise in race-related incidents after we heard the words Chinese virus and Kung Flu. An advocacy group says they've now marked over 2,300 hate incidents since the COVID-19 crisis broke out, from verbal harassment to refusal of service, even attempted murder against Asian Americans. Women are twice as likely to be targeted. Contributing factors include Asian Americans historically being racially associated with disease and existing bias about perceived foreignness over Asian cultures. Several of us defied expectations. Some of us became survivors of nuanced microaggressions even before the series of crises hit our country. Many of us walked with the Black Lives Matter movement, a nod to the history of anti-racist solidarity against systemic racism. And now, what are we to do amongst all this uncertainty and social unrest lying deep in a recession? Today, we hope the conversation offers you insight and takeaways from Asian American leaders in the world of marketing and advertising. Thank you in advance for listening. Without further ado, we welcome Cynthia Chen, President of Consumer Health North America at RB, who also sits on our Adweek D&I Council and will guide today's thoughts. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you, Cole, for the introduction and your kind words. It is my great honor to moderate today's session. Before we start, I would like to take this moment to thank Adweek, in particular, Nadine Diaz, for your leadership and continuous efforts on driving diversity and inclusion forward in our beloved industry. In addition, there is another leader I'd like to call out, Elliot Lam, hopefully that you are listening in, SVP at ANA. He was the original originator who got all the Asian American CEOs and CMOs together. So thank you, Elliot. Today is probably one of the most profound moments of my professional career. This is because we have a panel with a completely different complexion of all the panels I joined in the past. And we are all Asian Americans here today. We have a meaningful conversation ahead of us. So let's get started. First, let's do a quick self-introduction. And we also have one spontaneous question I just came up with. So this is a question. What is the best advice you've ever received? And what is the worst? Once you finish your section, please go ahead and call next panelist to start his or her introduction. Now I'll give you some time to prepare. I'll go first. My name is Cynthia Chen, again. I'm the president of Health North America. The best advice I got so far was there were only 30,000 days in life, so make it interesting. The worst advice I received was to expect that I could not make any true friends at work. So next, Kyle.
Hi everyone, my name is Kyle. I am the co-founder and CEO of Pixly. The best advice that I've received recently is that things are never as good or as bad as they seem. It's always in the middle. And how you deal with success is equally important as how you deal with failure. Probably the worst advice I've received was on career advice of me having to be a doctor or I would be a failure.
Oh, the Asian parents that ask us to become a doctor or scientist or engineers.
I guess I'll pick on Boone next.
Oh, hi, everybody. My name is Boone Lai. I'm the VP of Global Partner Marketing at Cisco. The best advice I've been given is actually a saying that I read somewhere, that if you change the way you look at things, the things around you change. So I thought it's a very nice way of looking at different perspectives. The worst advice I got is just my mom kind of always worrying and stopping me from doing things, I would say. So I'll pick Brad.
Thanks, Boone. I'm Brad Hirnaga. I work at General Mills and lead the marketing for North America. Best advice I got is stay present, be present in the moment, and it's a great way to enjoy life. Worst advice is probably to pick success over happiness. They're not necessarily always the same thing. I will pick on Marvin to go next.
Hey everyone, good morning. I'm Marvin Chow. I'm a global marketing lead at Google. I think the best advice I've been given has been really not to care too much about what everyone else thinks. And probably the worst advice, like many of us, is that, you know, if I don't study hard, I'll never amount to anything. So I'm going to pick on Soyoung.
Hi, everyone. I'm Soyoung Kang. I'm the chief marketing officer at EOS Products, personal care company. I would say the best advice that I ever got was that the legacy that we as leaders in our professional life will leave behind is less about the things that you did. It's more about the people that you helped along the way. And I think that the worst advice would be something similar about, you know, just become a doctor or a lawyer because that's the safest route that you can take in your career. So I am going to pick next on Helen.
Hi, everyone. This is Helen Lowe. I'm the SVP of marketing, overseeing our clients for the retail brokerage business at Charles Schwab. The best advice that I ever got was from one of the best salespeople I've ever met. And his advice was, when you're doing well, everyone knows it, including you. When you're not doing well, everyone knows it except for you. And so be sure to ask for advice and ask for feedback proactively, which I love. So always think of any kind of feedback as gift. The worst advice, just like everyone else is saying, to be a doctor. I was a pre-med starting in college and I realized I hated it. So thankfully I was able to switch, but guess what? I switched to engineering. So I also played a lot of it. You can't get any more stereotypical than that. All right, I am going to pick on, Minjay.
Hi everyone, I'm Minjay. I'm the CMO of Visible, the first all-digital wireless carrier in the United States. I think the best advice I've got and the worst advice I've got are kind of two sides of the same coin. So the best one was be yourself. It was hard to follow that earlier in my career or when I was younger, but now it's a reminder to kind of stay true to yourself and anchor yourself in who you are. The worst version of that in variety of versions I've heard was some sort of lead with fear. And it was kind of modeled based on what we've all probably experienced or witnessed in different places as to what leadership looks like. And I was told in different ways that you need to be exactly this way to be a leader, which turned out not to be true. Okay, let's see. Nick, have you gone yet?
I have not. Hi, everyone. I'm Nick Tran, head of global marketing for TikTok. Probably the best advice I got was probably from my parents, who encouraged me to do what I love. And they basically said, if you do that, you'll never work a day in your life. And they allowed me to pursue whatever I wanted to dream up. The worst advice I probably received was, it's actually a saying that means well, but act like you belong. But that idea of trying to act like you belong is actually counterintuitive, because mm-hmm. we shouldn't have to act like we belong. You know, everyone, no matter who you are, where you're from, should just belong.
Yeah.
So with that, I'd like to pass it off to Judy.
Thanks, Nick. Hi, I'm Judy Lee. I'm the Global Head of Experiential Marketing at Pinterest. And in terms of the best advice I've received, you know, it's very visual in terms of, think of like your knowledge and your leadership like a candle, and you're in a room full of candles. And by sharing that light, you light up the whole room, but it doesn't diminish your own light. Because I often sometimes think that people need to hold on to trade secrets or not share their knowledge. But I just think that mentorship and knowledge is something that we should give freely to everyone. And then in terms of worst advice, I think there's a lot of themes, because every time someone said something like, oh shoot, that's the one that I was thinking of. But I think for me, maybe a different take is, you know, not to speak up. You know, as a woman early in my career, people would say, you don't want to speak up too much. You don't want to come across as too aggressive, because people won't like you. And so that whole notion of having to be liked and to kind of fit in and belong. So let me see who hasn't gone yet. Has everyone gone?
I think everybody has done that. But thank you. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for all your wisdom. Very, very insightful. As Cole mentioned earlier, amid the ongoing threat of the coronavirus, there are surging reports about xenophobic and racist incidents targeting members of Asian Americans and Pacific Islander community in the United States. And these incidents obviously include being told to go back to China, being blamed for bringing the virus to the United States, being referred to with social racial slurs spat on or physical assaulted. Statements by public officials does not help either. They refer to COVID-19 as a China virus, Kung Flu or Wu Flu, and this exacerbated the scapegoating and also targeting of the AAPI community. So in this environment, in this context, how are you personally navigating today's heightened discussion on racial and also stereotypes against amidst the COVID bias? Do we have a brave soul here? Who wants to go first?
I'll go, it's Helen. As you're talking, Cynthia, I just feel so much rage. I mean, I'm just so outraged by all of this. I actually have a friend who runs an organization that tracks all these anti-Asian American hate incidents. There have been 2,000 of these incidents since March through June alone. And I think we've all seen that video recently of somebody who felt like he had the permission to say out loud in public in a restaurant just hateful slurs and terrible insults to a family that's having a birthday party. So sadly, that wasn't just an isolated incident. So I just feel really outraged, but at the same time, I feel really energized because I think it's galvanizing us as a community to come together. I mean, look at us. We've all been saying how great it is to have this community. We haven't come together before, but thanks to you, to Nadine, to Elliot, you know, we're coming together and we're having this conversation. So I'm really energized about it. And I think we should focus on not only this kind of outright racism, which is despicable, we need to denounce it, but also what's less visible, but real. And that is the systemic biases and the negative stereotyping that all of us, and I'm sure many people in the audience have felt. And that's something that I feel like we need to seize the moment right now and talk about it and have the conversation and shine a light on it and talk about what we can do about it.
Yeah, very well said. I mean, look at us, right? So I was just talking about all our Asian American leaders. We got together like a dysfunctional family. We got together. There's some new friends. There's some old colleagues like Brad. I used to work at General Mills. So great to see Brad here. So Brad, do you want to go for next?
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's good to see you too, Cynthia. I think it's interesting in a time, you know, I'm General Mills is headquartered in Minneapolis. And so obviously it's been the epicenter of you know, the murder of George Floyd. And so I think that had a pretty profound effect, I know, on me and a lot of the folks that work here at the company and everyone in this community. And so I got to be completely honest. You know, my background is my dad's Japanese and my mom's white. And so I grew up not necessarily like feeling I had a lot of the same headwinds that I know other Asian peers and colleagues I've talked to. And so while I grew up with that, I kind of felt a sense of guilt a little bit when things like that started happening that, you know, am I doing enough? Cause I look at myself in the mirror. I'm like, I'm not racist, but am I anti-racist? And that term has been kind of used a little bit more. And I think what this moment gives us, all as leaders is an opportunity to use our platforms and our experience as more and more people from Asian backgrounds and diverse backgrounds are coming up in companies to try to create a culture and try to create it, to make it easier for people to come up. And I think that's been a big learning. And to be honest, I felt a sense, a little bit of guilt and personally of like, okay, how come I'm not doing more? How come I'm not doing enough? So I feel like what Helen said and what you just were saying, Cynthia, is right. Like there's an opportunity, I think, here to have this community come together. And it's so diverse in and of itself. I mean, where everyone's backgrounds are from, but to come together in a really meaningful way. Because I think what's been really great is, you know, watching, you know, the Black Lives Movement and watching folks in the Hispanic groups that we have in our company, they've been rallying around this for a long time. And I feel like Asians don't often do that as overtly. And so maybe this is a rallying cry for us to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think, Brad, you know, it's so, what you said is so right. Even within our Asian Americans community, it's so diverse, right? So sometimes because your face looked like Chinese, right? Judy, you had a, you know, story about yourself and people thought you're Korean, but somebody just thought that you are Chinese, right? So maybe Judy, you can share some lights on this as well.
Sure. You know, I think similar to what Helen had mentioned as well, like, you know, when a lot of this started, I felt a lot of rage, you know, rage for everyone who's kind of been at the receiving end of racism or hate. And I think, you know, it made me reflect a lot about my past. I'm the child of immigrants, I'm Korean American, and I'm first generation here. And, you know, quite often I think about so much of my upbringing was about the American dream and being able to make it better than what my parents have or have a better life than what my parents have. But I think for many, especially when there are leaders out there who normalize hate speech and rhetoric, it makes it feel like it's okay to say that. And what we see are instances of people feeling really emboldened to hate. And I think, you know, some of you have touched upon that model minority myth. And I think it's that notion that Asian Americans won't stand up, that we won't fight back, that we won't say something when we're the target of that racism. And I think Ko had mentioned that this is happening especially to women. And I live in New York. I live in a really diverse neighborhood in downtown Brooklyn. And so, you know, those instances have happened on the street. You know, I can't tell you the number of times that people pulled their eyes back to to, you know, mock me, even when I haven't done anything, just walking. And so for me, I'm really focused on how do we prevent the American dream from becoming the American nightmare? And I think about my parents and kind of their whole intent for immigrating here is that they made a multi-generational bet. They knew that they would improve our lives as a family, but maybe not for themselves, but that for the future. And so for me, I'm thinking about what's that multi-generational bet I can make? I think that there's a lot of work to be done. And it's not that we haven't made progress in my lifetime, which I think we definitely have when I reflect about my childhood, but I think there's still a lot of work to be done. So I think, what can I do to lay that foundation for the future? And what progress can we make as leaders and use our platforms?
Judy, thank you. Very well said. You know, if you think about, you know, growing up, my parents always told me that don't stick out, right? So if there's anything, you don't want to be that sticking out, you know, song, because you will be beaten down right away, right? So it's very, very difficult. Our culture is very understated. So thank you for sharing that. Boone, again, Boone, used to work for RB. So now, nice to see you again, Boone.
Yeah, great to see you. I have to say, you know, just based on what Brad and Judy were talking about, I feel very similar in that I'm very concerned for my kids. You know, I have twin girls who are 4-year-olds. They are, you know, mixed race Americans. And, you know, the recent incident with this tech CEO in the Bay Area really hit home because, A, it's so close to home. And the same thing is, you know, since I've actually, you know, moved here to the Bay Area, I actually thought that this is actually one of the most accepting cities in the world, right? I mean, if you think about the Asian population here, in addition to other minorities. But the fact that this person feels like he has the right to say that and to do that in a public place is just, you know, kind of crazy, right? At a time like this, you know, I know it's a crazy time that we're living in. So I think the first thing is, you know, I'm very concerned for my kids, you know, that they will be, you know, kind of bullied in school or, you know, the prejudice that they might face growing up in this society. And that is really galvanizing, you know, as we talked about, right, for me personally. But the second thing I would say is that it's actually quite empowering because you see now that people are capturing it. You know, I work for a tech company. And technology is sort of the great equalizer now, right? It allows you to actually have a voice. It's actually allowing you to hold people accountable, you know, with this whole cancel culture. But it's also really, you know, making sure that people get being held responsible for the actions that they're taking. So, you know, I actually feel very positive and optimistic that this time around we can make a change and that, you know, technology and our attitude can actually help and change us.
Thank you. And then let me just think, you know, Marvin. You wrote an article which touched us, not only us here on the panel, but our broad Asian American community. Would you please share some of your thoughts?
Yeah, no, thanks, Cindy. I think everything, it's been really confusing. And I think, you know, a lot of what Boonline talked about in terms of like your kids and the generational part, I find is very interesting. And I think we have a lot of intellectual conversations. And I think for a while, it was very intellectual for me. And I think like a lot of us who live in the Bay Area, you think it's very accepting. We have a certain amount of privilege. And I remember I was with my kids and the first time walking through a mall in the South Bay where a guy just started yelling at me and being like, you know, blaming me and yelling, you know, not totally offensive, but, you know, like go back to China. This is all your fault, blah, blah, blah. And I was with my kids and a little bit like you talked about, Cynthia, in terms of like, I kind of froze because I was taught to kind of brush it off, you know, and that was where I would learn. So I kind of brush it off. I didn't want to make a scene. I didn't want to stand out. And when I thought back on it, it's like, that can't be how my kids grow up, kind of thinking that they can brush it off and having to have to stand up. And I think all of this has come together to think about, you know, how do we take the progress that we've made and then look at the next generation, not my kids are 7 and 9, but people coming in the workforce today and give them a platform and kind of an agenda of what does the Asian community want? You know, how do we come together? And I think this is how you dismantle communities is by fragmenting communities. You know, it's classic. And how do we come together and say, what is good for our community? What is good for the next generation, both in anti-racist work, in the workplace, in pay, in, you know, gender equality, and the power that we have, I still think is so untapped. And so I think there's so many pieces here, which I just find so fascinating. And this is just being a really interesting opportunity to take a big step forward.
Thank you, Marvin. Anybody else want to chime in here?
Yeah, I think what a lot of people are talking about is this normalization of racism. That's unacceptable. So I echo a lot of the statements that everyone else made. I also want to share perhaps a different point of view and of where I think I've personally struggled related to this topic. I think for a while I've struggled really having these conversations because I think during most of my upbringing, I was almost ashamed or trying to distance myself from the culture and my ethnicity because it was a source of a lot of bullying growing up. And I know that there's probably a lot of attendees that feel the same way and a lot of people in high school feeling the same way as well because it is a source of bullying, how you look growing up Asian American in the United States. Secondly, I was always afraid of having these conversations partially because I felt like, oh, no one cares what I think. I haven't done enough in my career or I'm not an expert on DEI. How am I qualified to have this conversation? And what I've learned and from others in the Black Lives Matter movement is that you can still speak up on your way to the top. You don't need to be at the top to have these conversations. And secondly, you don't need to be a DEI expert to be united against systemic racism. Those are a few of the things that I've personally struggled with and how, you know, I think over the last couple of months, I've kind of gotten better at it as well.
Yeah, I love the different takes and just wanted to add a different point of view as well. I agree with a lot of what people were saying, but at the same time, you know, I've always kind of grown up as an optimist. And I realized at one point when I started to feel a little bit of anger toward what was happening since, you know, racism and xenophobia are at an all-time high right now. I've never had my mind change when someone was, you know, acting out in rage or aggression. But that if you have that conversation, you open up a dialogue and you start with what's going on the other side and you sort of lead with like love for the most part, you can get real deep conversation and have something come out that you never would have expected. So when I've experienced a little bit of that microaggression, I always try to take the time and just pause and ask them like, what are you feeling right now? Why is that something that you felt the need to say? And just opening up that dialogue kind of puts people in a little bit of a check. And then you start to talk about it and they realize like, oh, that might not be the approach. Whereas if I feel like I, you know, acted a little bit more aggressively, it wouldn't have come out in the outcome that I ended up having.
If I can add to that, Nick, I will say yes, and some of you already talked about this just in terms of the feelings we're carrying with us, right? Particularly in the form of anger and rage and what we're experiencing, what we're witnessing. I've been reading a lot, just revisiting books like Rebecca Traister's book that came out when Me Too movement was happening, specifically around women and anger. Dr. Brittany Cooper's book about anger in the context of Black communities and Black women in particular. And anger in itself has been ingrained us as it's a bad thing. Like it's unbecoming, it's unproductive. And especially when we think about this in the context of Asian American community, a lot of the times of what you've already discussed of like, don't stick out is part of what you don't do with your anger. And only recently, as I'm dealing with kind of what I'm witnessing and what I'm experiencing, how do I not be ashamed of my anger? Like we should be so angry with everything mm-hmm. that is happening, but how do we do something productive with it? And and as business leaders, as well as you know, our kids, like people whose lives that we do have impact on, that's something that I've been thinking about a lot because part of this is also, yes, overt racism and comments and all of that. And what is that doing to how we feel and how we show up? But something I've noticed in myself personally is how much of that puts the management of how I show up, what I say, where I go in internal, you know, management of that, how much of that, more of that happens. So for instance, I haven't actually experienced in recent weeks someone saying something to my face in public, fortunately, but it makes me actually feel more safer when I wear a mask and go out. And I actually don't want to go out as much because I don't want to put myself in situations where that could happen. And then I realize, what am I talking about? Like, why do I feel this way? And the fact that a 41-year-old grown woman with lots of things to be able to write, stand up for myself and show up proudly and not be afraid of going outside in my neighborhood. Like, why does that happen? And so if I, as a person who has a lot of privilege and experience to be able to show up in this place is unapologetically imagine what other people feel, imagine what all of us may have carried in work environments or otherwise, and the psychological impact of what holds us back as a result.
I think, Minjay, that's such a, thank you for sharing that. That's, I feel like you've given me a ton of for thought. I also have been afraid. And I think about what you just said about if someone like me who has the tools to be able to defend myself and defend my family, really, because it's, I've been afraid to walk outside with my kids. And so if someone like me is afraid of that, then what does that mean for the rest of the Asian American community? Because we're among a very rarefied circle of panelists here. We're talking about people who are, you know, educated leaders, have a lot of tools at their disposal, and yet we are not the typical member of the Asian American community. And I want us to all remember that, and for anybody who's listening to remember that we are a member of a community that's incredibly diverse, but also has a lot of economic and social diversity that is putting certain, that is putting a large portion of the community at higher risk for being affected by, you know, the racism and the incidents and all of that. And I also think even back, a lot of us are children of immigrants. And so I think about, you know, what does it mean if I can't walk outside my door? What did my parents do when they went across an ocean, didn't know the language, and embarked on this journey to bring us what, you know, what Judy called the multi-generational opportunities? And what does that mean in terms of how brave I need to be on behalf of my children to stand up for what's right? A lot of folks have talked about being surprised about these things touching them in their circles. And I realized that the predominant, you know, because Cynthia asked the question, like, how am I feeling? And the predominant thing that I actually realized as I really reflected on this question was, I'm feeling a little disappointed in myself, both for the feelings I just described, but also because I realized that so much of my my journey to get to where I am today, coming from a children of very poor immigrants, has been to build a bubble around myself. And I don't know if that was conscious, but I definitely feel, if I look back, that I was creating this social, economic, and even geographic bubble living in New York City where I could feel comfortable and protected. But guess what? The bubble is fake. And for, you know, for anybody who thinks they're protected, there is no bubble. And if COVID and the incidents that have happened recently have shown me anything, it's that it's not a real construct. And that COVID is, and the things that we've seen are, those are a symptom, but there's an underlying real disease of racism that we do need to tackle for the long term.
Thank you, Sonia. Judy, do you want to add something here?
Yeah, no, I agree wholeheartedly. And, you know, So Young and I knew each other when we were younger, so we're familiar with each other's families. And, you know, something she said really resonated. So my parents are, you know, Korean grocery store owners in a relatively, like, poor place. And so just hearing So Young talk about the bubble, because at one point during, you know, many years ago when I was still in college, and the Rodney King trials and all of that had happened in LA, that was the year that they had to install a bulletproof glass in the store. And so as So Young was talking about that bubble of protection, it is both like mental, but also physical in terms of things that our community has had to do to protect themselves against violence. And I think, you know, just kind of hearing about that, like, definitely, again, takes me back. And that notion of fear and what do I do with that fear right now? And a lot of where I'm trying to focus, like, that energy, because I think, you know, it's not that I'm denying my rage and fear, because I'm accepting that. And that's, a, you know, built, has made me who I am today, you know, all the experiences that I've had. And how do I make that into something productive so that we can have a more positive legacy, so we can build this foundation where people won't have to struggle and as far back as we do, and that we can help normalize, and that brands or companies won't be considered brave when they put forth images of empowered people who are typically underrepresented, whether it's the Asian American community or any communities, really, any underrepresented groups. Like, I want to get to a place where a brand doesn't have to be considered brave for doing that work, and it just becomes normal, and it becomes, you know, part of who we are. And I think, especially in America, we often think about that notion of melting pot, And that's something that I used to embrace as a kid. And I thought that was empowering and inclusive. But in reality, it's about melting away your own identity. And it's about becoming this blob culture that is very specific to the US. And one of my friends in Canada had often said, you know, we think of it as a mosaic and everyone has their individual identities and they bring that. And that is the culture that she participates in. And so I've always loved that notion of a mosaic rather than a melting pot, where all of our identities kind of melt away. And I think it was Brad who had mentioned that earlier in one of our conversations about what can we do to like retain our identities and feel empowered by it. When for a few of us and me specifically, I did a lot to erase that, to try to assimilate and try not to feel different from the white communities that I lived in growing up.
Yeah, I think Judy, you know, your story is a very, very good story. And your story plus Kyle, last time you mentioned about bamboo ceiling. Right, that led me to think, I thought about this quite a bit in the last 2 days. For Asian Americans, there's one I would call the only experience. This experience is really huge. I personally heard so many times is, I would be the only Asian American, day-to-day life, the only Asian American in a room, in a meeting, or in a team setting. As a matter of fact, we have statistics to back it up. And more than 80% of the time, Asian Americans, we are the only one in the room. And this is even more so for Asian American women, especially in senior positions, the only experience. We know from the research that are conducted in the past, when you are an only, you are much more likely to experience microaggressions. And It's something sometimes I call that the paper of 1,000 cuts, right? If you add up, so over time, I don't know about you guys, but I personally certainly felt that sometimes I felt I don't belong, right? Especially you guys, probably the first generation. I'm probably generation zero. So I know that I'm the only person that actually have accent. So sometimes I do feel that pain that I don't feel that I belong, right? But I always wake up and to Sungyang, your point, you know, your parents actually, came to the United States overseas. And we are here, actually, we are in this pseudo bubble. So I'm going to motivate myself and stand up for myself, but also for our next generation. So what do you think, Kyle? Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that bamboo ceiling.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is probably a topic that a lot of the attendees have thought about as well. For me, you know, there have been studies that show that Asian Americans are the least likely to get promoted to management. And if you take it and look at, say, the marketing industry as an example, working in the user-generated content space, we get to see a lot of the diversity of all the amazing creators on platforms like TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. And what you'll notice in these platforms is that they tend to over-index, for example, with the Asian American and African-American communities, yet those communities are very underrepresented in both marketing and media. And for me, my question has always been, why? Why are there so few Asian-Americans in CMO roles or C-level roles in these organizations? Like, is it a capacity issue, right? I don't think it's a pipeline issue if you think about the data that I just shared with you. Or is it a scenario where there are stereotypes where you think that we don't have the charisma or confidence or interpersonal skills to become a leader? So for me, the bamboo ceiling has always been a really fascinating topic because when people talk about other minority groups, you know, they use Asian Americans to essentially try to put them down in some ways. And they have these conversations about pipeline issues. And I think the Asian American community shows that it's not just a pipeline issue when it comes to diversity and C-level positions. It's much far greater than that. And I think the examples I gave in the marketing and advertising industry are probably good examples where, hey, look at the top creators on some of these platforms, and you go to Cannes, you see a very, very different point of view.
Thank you.
Kyle, this is Helen. I think this is such a huge point that it is not just the pipeline. It's not enough to get in the building, because I think oftentimes Asian Americans as a whole, because of the model minority myth or trap, they're like, oh, there are plenty of you in the building. Let's not worry about you. But it's not just about getting in the building, right? Once you look up a couple floors, and definitely at the top, as Cynthia said, you don't see us. We're not there. And so it's more than a pipeline problem. I just want to relate a story that hopefully many people can relate to. Early in my career, and this is related to what Judy said about the melting pot. Early in my career, I was told that I wasn't get promoted, wasn't going to be getting promoted first batch, right? We all want to be A students. Like, how do I get promoted in the first batch? And my manager was very honest. He said, you know what? You're doing everything right. You're analytical, you're a good problem solver, you know, you get great results, but your behaviors don't fit the expectations we have for a leader. I'm like, oh no, I can fix that. I can get an A there too. So just tell me what I need to do. And he said, you are not aggressive enough. You're not commanding enough. So I asked for a role model and he named a couple of people. I'm like, wow, really? I got to go that far, you know, because it's a matter of overcompensating, right? Because I was seen as too meek. So I got to go all the way to the other end. So anyway, good news is I did that. I got promoted. But later in my career, pretty soon after that, I got a different kind of feedback. And it was from my peers. Helen is too aggressive. Helen is too focused on her goals, too focused on her team. She's too territorial. She's not collaborative enough. And really, I mean, what I said earlier is true. I take all feedback as a gift. So, you know, always try to improve myself. And I do that all the time. But I think it's just such a good lesson, you know, just for all of us just to hear that out loud, because I know it happens to all of us, that it's not enough to just conform. It's not enough to just do, you know, study to the test. We have to find our own strength and be able to shine through so that we not only take the feedback and get better at it, get promoted, but that we also can leapfrog and build our own leadership model. Well, I'd love to hear others' thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I want to build on that a little bit. So what's really interesting is that, you know, I didn't grow up in the US, I grew up in Asia. And when I came here to college, one of the things that was really interesting was, you know, there's this like 15% of class participation in order for you to get your A. And I failed miserably my first year, and I've never been a great student anyways, but it did really teach me how to, you know, come to the table and have a voice and, you know, be able to speak out, right? To prepare yourself and to always have a point of view. And I think that you know, kind of has helped me through my career working in different places and different continents to always, you know, come prepared and actually, you know, really not be afraid to really say something or ask the questions, right? Our counterparts don't feel that way. So why should we? I mean, I think even just drawing on this whole conversation, when we were offered this opportunity to speak at this panel, I think we were talking amongst ourselves, are we ready to actually have this conversation? And the question is not really, are we ready? Is are we ready to actually have, you know, to actually put our voice out there and actually to start the discussion, right? To listen and to learn and to create that platform. The second thing that I would just say is that just to build on your point, Helen, you know, I've read also a little bit more about, you know, the difference between mentorship and sponsorship, right? Mentorship is really about advising somebody, but sponsorship is really helping somebody advance their career. And so, you know, and I've read somewhere as well, I think the leadership advisory somewhere that, you know, if you look at, compared to our white male counterparts, 1 in 5 white male have a sponsor. I think 1 in 8 women have a sponsor and 1 in 12 minority have a sponsor. So what can we do, you know, especially in the position of power and strength to really help the minorities' representation around us in this area as well?
Yeah, Boone, I think that's a key, because as I was reflecting on Kyle's you know, thoughts from a couple days ago, it hit me hard when I took this new role, and I never felt that before, but I saw a lot of people reach out to me on LinkedIn, especially people in, you know, in different parts of their career saying, do you have any advice? You're the first Asian American I've seen get to this level. And I was sort of shocked because I've always looked to Marvin as like sort of like the bar in my mind. So I was like, no, are you kidding me? There's Marvin Chow at Google. And they're like, like, is there anyone else? And that's when it hit me. I was like, you don't have the network like other groups do. Like, you always talk about this like idea of like Boys Club or like different communities or different groups, and they all have this network. And I realized like I hadn't done a good job developing my, you know, personal network with you guys. So that's why I was so excited that Elliot invited us together, and I saw, you know, I was like, there are a lot of, you know, Asian Americans that are doing amazing things. It's sort of on me to make sure that I reach out and start to create this network so that we can also identify the like movers and shakers and the rising stars and help them and sponsor them in the same way that you guys are speaking about right now.
Nick, you need to aspire bigger, but I appreciate it. To build on like what Nick and Boone said, I think I think it kind of goes back to this community thing where it's like, I think so many of us, particularly first generation, we were just trying to be the first in our family to make it at kind of all costs. It was very competitive. And, you know, I think, and not that I'm ashamed of that, but I think we didn't care about everyone else in the community. And I think when you look at other communities, like Tiffany R. Warren, who does Ad Color, they have this motto, like, stand up, reach back. And I don't think we reach back enough. I genuinely don't think a lot of us, if we ask ourselves, how much have we invested in the next generation or the next wave of Asians to be successful and invest in the network and invest in the sponsorship and the mentorship? I don't think we've done that because it was never ingrained in us that the success of the community was important. This, our success was important. And I think that's something that I've been thinking a lot about as I've progressed in my career. And I think doing things like this, because Nick is exactly right. I was shocked when I would do things and people would look at me and I'd be like, I'm just trying to do me. I'm like, you do whatever you need to do. I'm just trying to get by. And I'm like, I'm still in the struggle. But I think we have to recognize that we do have to reach back and we have to support the community or else everyone's on the treadmill and no one's going to make any progress.
Yeah, I think, Marvin, you are too modest. You are doing really well. But I would say that today is the first step. Right. So, and the other thing is Nadine, actually in AdWeek, there's a mentoring program, D&I mentoring program. I'm part of that. So I would, I would encourage you guys to work with Nadine and to be part of that broader D&I summit. Anybody else? If not, we're going to move to the next question because we have lots of, other questions, and more discussion to be had. So making progress in these areas means placing them at the center of the organizational conversation. In times like this, that can be hard. You know, if you think about all the events have unfolded recently, they bring with them, obviously a hotbed of emotion. And, Sonyang, you mentioned anger, right? Minjun, you also mentioned anger, the emotion. But emotion alone will not help us. So what are the things that you are doing in your company? What are the things that that you are doing to lead your team throughout this pandemic? Anybody else?
I was just going to contribute because I think we've talked about, fear and anger. I think one of the most important things that I've heard repeated a lot during this pandemic is the word empathy. And I think that empathy is such an important part of leading through turbulent times, no matter what those times are. And frankly, this is the most turbulent time I've lived through in my career, between the pandemic and the racial injustice movement happening across the country. So empathy is such a critical part of how we as leaders can be the most effective. It's about having empathy for the members of our team who are going through things emotionally. And to be honest, people on my team didn't know how I was feeling about some of the injustice happening against the Asian American community due to COVID because I didn't talk about it. They actually reached out to me and said to me, I saw your post on LinkedIn that you're participating in this thing. And I saw that you talked about having been on the receiving end of hate and microaggressions. And that was just, they were just really, intrigued about hearing more about my story and my struggles. And what I realized was that part of leading with empathy is sharing what you've been through to create a more open environment for dialogue, because my journey, my struggles, and the things that I've been through aren't necessarily going to be what different members of my team who represent many different backgrounds and ethnicities, it's not going to be the same, but it helps to foster a more open conversation in the workplace that allows all of us to be able to bring our whole selves to work. And then to bring to light other issues, in particular, it's so critical with the Black Lives Matter movement happening right now that people feel comfortable enough to bring their whole selves and to talk about these things, because it is a really stressful time to be a member of corporate America and also as a leader to be able to help the team to relieve some of that stress and have an outlet for a broader conversation is such a critical thing for us to be doing right now.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that, as a leader, showing vulnerability is a greater quality.
Yeah, I'd love to just build on that because I agree wholeheartedly with what Soyoung has been saying in terms of, I feel like, listening and making space to have these conversations and by leading in that space, I think especially as an Asian American woman, I feel like it's not just about the Asian American community for me, it's about all underrepresented groups. And how do I create a safe space to talk about it? Because I think one of the things that happens, and I'm sure we're all on social media, is that sometimes you're like, wait, is this how people really communicate to each other? And I think people get so triggered around things and, you know, that lead to that cancel culture versus what if someone actually has a genuine question? Or, you know, if somehow they just have been oblivious or like they just don't know. And one example, like I'm a huge lover of hip hop music and it just kind of really bummed me out this week to see Cardi B post about, oh, I didn't know that chinky eyes was like a negative slang. And I was like, oh my gosh, really? Like how have you gotten so far in your life and you didn't know? But the other thing is like, maybe she really didn't know. And so like, how do we create that space, maybe not on social media, but in our business communities where people can ask those questions? Because I think what's worse is if they don't ask the questions and they remain ignorant versus if we can create those spaces where it is safe to have an honest and authentic discussion.
One of the things that I think that was really well said, Judy. One of the things I think that's really kind of at the crux of this is even for us, as far as we've gotten, is how do we continue to be really vulnerable ourselves? And I think Marvin's comment resonated with me too. Like it's been a grind for everyone to get as far as they have. But, and sometimes I think, you know, as a leader, you're like, I got to shut that vulnerability off. But I think through COVID and through, you know, just connecting like this, a lot of these pretenses go away. And I think we're seeing more each other be human every day. So that's a way, at least I think interpersonally, like, you know, each of us can own it. The second thing I feel like is one of the things that I can control or teams can control is like, how do we continue? Because we talk a lot about this. Every company I'm sure we all work for is saying the same things. They want diversity, they want inclusion, they want belonging. But I think some of those actions are of how do you create the most diverse teams possible? And I think a lot of companies do that really well through, you know, Hogan assessments and strength finders and all that stuff. And that's great. And we need that. But the contextual lives that everyone else brings to the table with race and gender and affinities, like that stuff too, that makes up the diversity of a person. And so I think the opportunity is to springboard forward to really truly try to build teams that are very diverse. Because we all know we get to the best solutions on problems when we do that. And sometimes that's been hard. I think we've looked at it too narrowly. And so there's an opportunity to really like lean into that and figure that out, just which I believe will help us pull in folks that may have been left off teams before.
Yeah, I think for me, what I've said internally is that it's more important what you do internally than what you say externally. But if you do say externally, your actions need to be consistent. And I think as a leader, sometimes during these conversations, your expectation of yourself is to have all the answers. But I think you don't have to have all the answers, but what you absolutely need to do is listen. So for me, part of that was just listening to other people's opinions internally. And you know, they have a lot of good suggestions. And secondly, just communicating early and often, even if I didn't have the exact perfect statement internally, taking them through the thought process or the timeline in which we think we're gonna do something. And then in addition, for me personally, this was a unique scenario because part of the reason why we do what we do is to bring more diversity to marketing. So it's something I've been personally very passionate about over the last decade. So for me, it was just about make sure we double down and amplify the voices of others that have made have done a lot of great work in this space.
So if I could add to that, to your point, Cynthia, emotion is emotions, but acknowledging and what you do with it is incredibly important. And so in the context of more recent events, one of the things that we've been doing at the company level is carve out spaces for emotion and learning and empathy versus carve out spaces for action. At first, we were trying to do all at the same time, and sometimes it was really difficult because we're all in different places. We bring different experiences, and Judy, to your example, that's the most extreme kind of right version of like, where are we right now? And one of the things that I've really learned is that, man, people are on different spectrums based depending on where you grow up or what your experience has been. So depending on that, some people are super close to action. Others are still on their journey of action. But the point is we need everyone to be as close to action as quickly as possible. So how do we make that happen as companies, as business leaders and programs? But the other thing is, and we talked a lot about kind of like we in our roles, like how do we navigate these situations or what is it? Because this is a long game, right? Like to your point about the multi-generational impact of what we need to do here. So before I took my job at Visible, I actually briefly considered going into HR because people and culture are really the true foundation and ingredients of how we live and work together, right? And ultimately drive results as businesses. And I don't know, maybe that'll be true for me later down the road. But the reason I decided to stick to the path I'm on right now is because every one of you and a lot more of you that I'm not necessarily seeing your faces as attendees, unless the business leaders do and practice the behaviors we want to see in workplaces, as great as HR partners and people operation partners and DA&I programs can be, it's not going to be as impactful as us practicing and pulling people along. So that's something that I'm thinking about a lot. And I would love to learn more from all of you to be able to make this into a systematically positive progress.
Yeah, I mean, I can build on that a little bit. You know, I think one of the learnings that I had recently is, you know, the ability to give permission, right? To give permission to my team, to give permission for them to express how they feel. And it's kind of interesting, you know, I talked about all these different perspectives. You know, we all work for global companies. And, you know, so, you know, with all this, you know, fast changing geopolitical situation, you know, 5G and all those things, we can bring our perspective based on, you know, our culture, our background, and where we've worked before. But the other thing that's really interesting is I have a lot of my friends outside of the US asking me, why is it so difficult for Americans to wear masks? You know, what's going on with the Trump administration, right? Like, you know, and so I think, you know, it's being able to have those open dialogues to try to share the perspectives and the history as to why we behave the way that we do. And, you know, one really interesting example was, you know, my team actually came to me and said that they wanted to actually have a D&I panel in my all hands meeting. And I was very, very nervous about it because I didn't know what to say or do or act. Like I didn't have the answer, but you know, because you know, but I thought that this was such a right time, and it was something that we were all feeling so passionate about. So they had a panel with African Americans, with Asians, with white, and you know, they basically you know just shared their perspective. And it, what really came out that was very positive was that this was actually our highest rated town hall, and it's just basically people wanting to have a platform and an ability to actually share their opinions. And so that was actually a big learning for me, right? To be able to give permission to my team and to actually, you know, express their vulnerability as well.
Yeah, I just want to add that I think we're all talking about how we're leading in this moment. And someone said earlier, Minjay, I think you said, this is a long game too. Like, how do we seize this moment? How do we take this moment to think about our leadership and how do we contribute and bring the whole community along? And so I just want to suggest that there's mentoring, there's sponsorship, and then there are scalable ways to level the playing field. How do we build scalable ways to level the playing field? And that's definitely not something that we can do on our own and possibly not even each company. I do want to mention an organization that I've been involved with, just as an example. It's a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to building leadership for the AAPI community. It's called Ascend. Just the word ascend, rise up. And what I love about that organization is that it really believes that we can empower ourselves as well as raise awareness and build advocacy with corporations. So they have a leadership development program with titles like the Asian, the Model Minority Myth, the Asian American Model Minority Myth or something like that. And it really goes at the heart of how do we become leaders? How do we become strong leaders? Taking into consideration some of the blind spots that we might have as perceived by others and still retain our authenticity and our strengths. And I think if we can all think about ways to build that sort of platform, whether it's with nonprofit organizations that already exist or within our own community, marketing, you know, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity to do things like that so that it's really scalable. Because we need to reach behind and pull a lot of people so that they can all rise up together.
Yeah, I think that Helen, that word scalable is super, super important. I would actually take this one step further. One is that we are making this impactful, but The second one is scalable. And the third one is how can we make it sustainable, right? So because we are in this moment and, you know, Asian hate crimes is at the heat of it. So we're talking about this. But for me, it's, you know, to Minja, your point, it's not about only about now. It's about how do we make that sustainable. 5 years later, we can come back to say, you know what? We actually made a huge progress. I would love to hear the panelists, your insights.
So, I completely agree with you, Cynthia. I was thinking about, how do we, move these issues forward? I was thinking about how, like, we need to work hard to not get complacent, because COVID will end at some point. And with that, the specific incidents that have brought us together as a community around, like, racism against, you know, people who look like us in the middle of coronavirus, that will go away. But, you know, like I said earlier, that's a symptom. That's not the disease. The disease is racism. And when COVID goes away, I would just encourage us all to remember that the disease still exists. It exists for, you know, all minority groups. And that Helen mentioned the model minority myth, and I was thinking about it more, and because I actually have had people, like, you know, ask me, you know, what's wrong about being considered good? Like, why what's bad about that? It's because it's a conditional acceptance into the society. It has an asterisk next to it, that you are acceptable if you conform to these specific standards and parameters, and that in and of itself is racism. And what you can see is that when the going gets tough at times like this during COVID, that conditional acceptance goes away for some people, and then you really see the ugly symptoms come out. So, I completely agree with Minjay and Helen. It's a long game. But I think what's really great is that we're having the dialogue now to be able to call it what it is. And I really firmly, hope that we all continue these dialogues long past when this specific era is behind us.
In addition, just to add on to the model minority myth, I think the Asian American community also needs to do a better job of rejecting some of the model minority myth, because over the last few weeks, it's been used, and the idea of the Asian American model minority myth has been used to negate the existence of racism towards other communities. And I think it's something that needs to be said and addressed.
I think it's really interesting. Like, I agree, like, you know, even going back to Minjay's, like, productive anger point, like, I think things that we do to break the stereotype are really important. I think, and once again, the next generation will do that. And I think if you go back to, you know, the origins of the model minority phrasing, you know, I'm pretty sure, like, it was created by, you know, by white people to try to get black people to behave. You know, they created this term to say, like, why can't you be like the Asian people? They're the model minority. And I think it was just, even the phrase itself was meant as a derogatory way to say, like, oh, why can't you just get, you know, fit in and kind of, like, get, like, pretend that you belong in that sense. And so I think that, you know, going back to all racism, I think it has interesting roots in that sense. And, you know, I kind of agree with everyone else. I think it is going to be a long game. I think, you know, I always go back to, you know, I was watching, you know, Dave Chappelle had his stand up on Netflix like a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago. I don't know, COVID time, can't remember. But it was like, you know, he was kind of joking. He's like, you know, I'm done with you motherfuckers. He's like, you next generation, you have to take it. He's like, I've taken it as far as I can go. I want you to take it, not because he's being lazy, but because, once again, the next generation will have a new spin, a new bar of what success is. And I think sometimes, you know, I think we have to check ourselves and be like, is our bar even good enough? You know, because our bar is from when we were coming up, and it's like, oh, is that, like, good enough? And I think there's a level of, like, reestablishing what the bar of success is for the next, you know, 10, 15, 20 years is going to be really important and help us all frame what we should be doing and what we should be working towards.
You know, go ahead, Judy.
I was going to say, you know, when I think about the future, just like building on what a lot of people are saying, because I'm in marketing, I think in threes, in terms of, like, one is like people and representation. Like, what can we as marketers do to ensure that we are represented. Crazy Rich Asians shouldn't have been like a phenomenon. That should just be normal. Asians should be able to play Asians in movies, and that shouldn't be an exception. So I think it's people, not only in representation in terms of our campaigns and what we do and what we can influence, but also the teams and kind of making that space for people from a leadership perspective and building pipelines for all underrepresented groups overall. So I think people is one. I think the second is wallet. And who do we choose to invest with? What are the partners and the companies and the agencies? And I think, you know, whether or not it's true, I often think back on the myth of Beyonce leaving that room with a sportswear brand because no one in the room looked like her. And so I think, you know, as we think about where do we invest our money, I think that's another kind of powerful way that we can express ourselves or figure out how do we have more equity. And then I think third is education and influence. And I think that's, you know, a lot of what we're doing here today. And how do we continue to make space to educate others and use our influence, you know, in varying degrees to amplify these voices and have these discussions? Because I think the other thing is we don't win when we're in a room where we're this wonderful panel of Asian Americans talking only to other Asian Americans. It's when, you know, that aperture is broadened. And then there are people of multiple ethnicities and backgrounds in the room with us. And we're all having this conversation together.
Yeah. I love that, Judy.
I would love to. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I was going to bring up a point about marketing too, because I think the way that we can all think about roles and the people that are on this, listening on the under this panel that are all in marketing, I think we're fortunate to be in this industry because our voices and the platforms that we run with on big brands that everybody knows about or companies that are really important, it's just another good reason that we all didn't choose finance, because this is a place that we can actually be really bold with how we want to communicate. And as we get to more and more folks that are in these roles, I think Judy's right. Like, the people that we choose to partner with, the culture that we choose to amplify and build, are all opportunities for us to create the right type of equality and the right type of images that we want as people go forward. So much, I think maybe Kyle talked about this, so much of the culture right now is being created by all sorts of different parts of young upcoming Asian influencers. And I think as brands, like, you know, oftentimes we'll call multicultural spending. And I know at the top of multicultural spending is Hispanic, because it's the biggest. And then there's Black, because it's really very influential. And then it's like, oh, and by the way, if there's anything left over, Asian also. And by that point, there's not enough dollars to go around. And so I think it's going to take some brands and brands that we probably all control and other people on the call to say, how do we actually like make some choices here and like lean in here? Because with Black Lives Matter and everything happening, I'm sure lots of the brands out there are leaning in hard on that. And it feels like it feels timely, but it's also because it's such in our face. We gotta be championing this community as well, so that we can make it feel like it's in people's faces. I think that's really important.
Yeah,
I sorry, Cynthia, I didn't mean to cut you off. No.
You're absolutely right. I could not agree more. I would say that, I always say that to my team, is a hashtag, be a helper, right? So
yeah.
By that is great power comes with great responsibility, as Brad, you said, right? I would say there are three things that I will commit to do. First and foremost is hiring and promotions, make sure that they are fair, right? So Helen, your experience was not isolated. I had the same experience when I was younger. The second one is that how can we foster inclusive and respectful culture? And I think that somebody mentioned that diversity and inclusive are different. We are always counted as diversity, right? So Asian Americans is always diversity, but inclusiveness, we are not part of that, right? So how can we change that? And the third piece is, how do we dedicate to make only experience really rare? We should not be the only Asian American. We should not be the only Asian American female to be in the room, particularly in a senior positions.
Can I just build on that, Cynthia? I think, you know, sort of for myself, I think the three things I would kind of focus on is, at the end of the day, we're all humans and we're leaders. So the first step is to really, a very small step, but to recognize that this is a stressful time for everybody and take time to ask people how they are, right? To really give that permission to have that conversation and to be vulnerable. I think the second thing is, as we talked about earlier, to report racist incidents and classify them as hate crimes, right? We want to see those, you know, we need to document that. So that it actually gives us, you know, leverage and data to have those conversations. And then the third thing is really trying to stay positive myself and focus on what I can drive, what impact I can make. And as part of that, you know, I've been working with an NGO as well called Multiplier Effect Pledge that takes a pledge to say we will sponsor one person of a minority talent to advance in their career. And the website for that is multiplydiversity.com. So that's something I would encourage and challenge our panel to do that as well.
Anyone else?
I think for me, one would be, you know, paying and promote people based off of their talents and not just their privilege. Second would be to push for more diverse content, because I personally believe in the power of storytelling. And there's both a business case and a moral case for more diverse content. And to echo kind of some stuff that Nick talked about on the optimistic side, there are some amazing stories out there, and the marketing and advertising industry plays a critical role in shaping culture and society. And there are some amazing stories that are out there to be amplified, and that storytelling helps humanize different people as well. And then last but not least, support small business. There's already great entrepreneurs out there that are doing some amazing work. And you know, they've been really hurt during COVID. And if you look at the diversity of small business owners, you'll notice that they very much make up that American dream.
Yeah, I love that. Just to add to Kyle's point, in addition to what we're doing within our organizations, I also try to see how we can influence the mission of the companies that we're at. If you look at the list of companies that we all work for, they're significant. And if we actually rally our passion into what the company's mission is as well, there's so much we can do. Like, I'm thinking about my situation alone, and every day I think about how can I amplify underrepresented voices? How do I bring those to light? And how do we democratize content at scale and showcase those folks that otherwise wouldn't have been seen? And that sort of gives me that fire to keep going.
I think I'm also building on something that that Kyle said, but you talked about representation, and in particular, when you think about creators in the industry that I work in, which is, you know, beauty and personal care, I think having and embracing and being careful about how we think about beauty standards across different groups is a really important one as well. And that may be it's a very specific thing to my industry, but it's been a really vocal, an issue with a lot of spotlight in terms of, specific to the Asian community. I think, you know, different standards of beauty within Asian faces, it's such an important part of being able to see the beauty and how different we all are. And I think that goes for all different groups of color. And I know that there's been a lot of conversation lately in particular around like skin color and representing darker skins as being beautiful. And I would encourage, everyone who's participating in this to think about Asian beauty and how it spans a very, very wide range of different types as well.
So if there's no other comments, we'll go to Q&A from attendees. So we have a lot of questions here, but let me go through this. The first one is, what is being done to improve Asian American promotions into management? First question.
Are there things being done?
Yeah. I guess the question that, are there anything being done? If so, what have been done so far? So, you know, the silence tells me that not a lot of things have been done. So maybe the panelists can share, how did you get to the top? So I actually want to pick Marvin, right? So Marvin, you're doing really well. And Nick was talking about that. Yeah, you are the inspiration. How did you get to the global marketing at Google?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think, I mean, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword because, you know, I got to where I am by kind of, you know, like the Nick thing, like acting like I belong. Like I got there by, you know, there's a lot of talk around code switching and like, you know, how you have to fit in to kind of get there. And I think I did all of that. And it's like, I think it worked. But when I look at, once again, people coming up now, I tell that story, but it's not the advice I give because it shouldn't be how, you shouldn't have to fit in to kind of, or conform to the Anglo-Saxon leadership model to get ahead. And I think a lot of the conversations that we have or I've had with different people coming up is just, you know, one on the people side, like how do you flex different kinds of leadership styles? You know, I think many companies have this Anglo-Saxon leadership style, which is also why a lot of Europeans get promoted because it comes from Anglo-Saxon. It's not just an American thing. It's an Anglo-Saxon thing. So how do you flex if you're introverted or if you're a language barrier, how do you flex different ways that you can lead and be effective in your job? And then on the leadership side, how do we become more embracing of other leadership styles? Because I think it goes back to proximity. Like if everyone that you are around is like this loud, boisterous leader, then you just think everyone needs to be this loud, boisterous leader to be successful. And you have to have people you can point to that says that that person's not an asshole, that person is not super loud, that person, but is still really effective and can drive followership. People want to follow that person and do what she or he wants to get done. And I think that on both sides, like really helping both sides bridge that leadership gap, I think is the most important thing. And I really hope that, you know, everyone has to flex a little bit to be a little bit who they aren't, just as normal as a leader. But I think having to pretend to be or fit in to a culture that's not yours is just, it shouldn't be like that.
Helen, you have anything to add?
Well, that resonates a lot with me, Marvin, what you said about having to flex on both sides. And as I mentioned earlier, that's why I personally really benefited from leadership development where I became more self-aware. I think self-awareness is a really strong asset really for anyone in leadership development and in life and everything. But it really became self-aware that these are my blind spots when it comes to the mode I have to fit in, but at the same time, I shouldn't have to conform. It's a real finesse. Like, how do I fit in to the mode so I come across as the right leader that everyone expects? But then how do I also shine a light on what's authentic in my own strength? One of the reports that I read a couple years ago was really instrumental in sort of helping me with that, my own journey. And it was a report that was done to study minority women of all colors, women of color, and how they rose up through the ranks. It was a qualitative study, but it was a big enough sample. And the surprising finding was that these women made it because they looked for the white space. It was like true innovation. And the reason is obvious when you say it out loud. They're overlooked for the most sort of sexy opportunities. And so what they did was they applied all their smarts to find the next opportunity that no one was looking at the time. They found the white space, they pitched it, they got the leadership, and then they grew that. And so they became the leaders. And I just thought that was such an important lesson, which is that we need to look to our own strengths, what we're good at, and look for the white space or just look for the sexy space. It doesn't matter, but apply our own strength and our own brand, if you will, to make it there.
Yeah, so for me, I want to share something here as well. For me is, you know, I'm very self-aware. Even my accent is very, very strong. You know, I definitely is not, Anglo-Saxon, right? So the first foremost is that I tell myself I need to work extra harder, right? I need to be better than anybody in anything I do. The second piece is that when you are ready, you also need to voice out. Nobody believes that, but I'm actually extremely introverted. I'm very, very shy. As a matter of fact, I think Judy, you were talking about Beyonce. When I was at General Mills, Brad, you will appreciate that. I was ABM in a class of 50 people. I'm the only person who is not from top five schools. We have lots of people from Harvard, HBS, Kellogg, and top five business schools. I'm the only, probably only international, and the only person who is not from top five schools. So I had this huge chip on my shoulder. So at that time, I came across a documentary talking about Beyonce, and Beyonce has a stage name, Sasha Fierce. So I gave myself a stage name. So from that time on, I pushed myself. I follow that rule. If you push yourself 21 times, if you push yourself to talk at a meeting 21 times, it becomes a habit. And it worked for me. So again, you know, you got to work, you got to sharpen your chop and be the best of everything you do. At the same time, when the time is ready, go out and tell people it is a time you deserve a promotion, you know. And sometimes people will say, well, you're probably a little bit too aggressive, a little bit like a bee, but it's okay, right? So I'm okay for people to tell me that I'm a little bit aggressive, right? Although deep down, I'm, you know, from time to time, I'm actually scared because I'm introverted. And I'm shy, but I forced myself, and it worked.
I'll build on that a little bit. You know, I think one of the things is really learning to build our differences as a strength. right? And I shared this in our panel discussion before, you know, where, you know, like the top three most asked questions in my career, right? Which is, you look very young. Where, you know, how old are you? Are you really good at math? You speak really good English. Where are you from? Right. So, you know, I had to learn to use those, you know, in my career and acknowledge that up front. Like when I came for my interview at Cisco, you know, my first thing I said to the CMO was, you know, by the way, I know I look really young for the job, but, you know, and then I kind of shared. And it's not a little bit apologizing, but it's actually trying to just sort of recognize that up front and use it to your advantage. And then the second thing I would say is, you know, if I look at my career and when I got, you know, finally made the executive and became VP, it was because I had a sponsor in the room who was a woman who was not, you know, from, you know, it was Australian actually, and she believed in me. And so I think the onus is also on us to recognize those differences in the talent within our organization and help to promote that.
Yeah, I don't think I would be where I am without people advocating for me. And one thing I would say, especially for, you know, myself, where I feel like I'm still coming up in my career, is that it's incredibly empowering to see people who look like you be celebrated. Like, I cannot stress that enough, especially in industries in which Asian Americans are not well represented.
The two biggest things I'm taking away from this are how awesome Minjay's glasses are, and then everyone in the chat asking about your stage name, Cynthia. Like, you're going to have to come back to that. The one thing.
Next time, when I have a couple of...
You're going to use it as a teaser? I like that. That's good. I can speak on behalf of Cynthia, too, because I did work here with her, and she is a badass. So the only other thing I was going to say, because I know there's a lot of talk about how much leaning into yourself versus you kind of have to kind of give up, acquiesce a bit to fit in. I would say the further along you get, obviously, the easier it is to lean into yourself. But everything that's a stereotype and things that are outside of that are superpowers for everybody on this call, right? Everybody in that's listening in. You know what your superpowers are. If you don't, like, be reflective and figure that stuff out. Because I think it's easy to try to fit into places where you don't look the same. But oftentimes what your superpower is going to be really different. And companies, if they don't even know it, it's going to be extremely valuable for them. So that's one thing we talk about a lot. And even just in feedback with multicultural or non-employees, it's like, how do you find your superpower and like lean into it in a hard way? And then I love what Helen said about white space. I mean, we do that as marketers. Where's the white space? Like, figure out where that white space is for you in your career and use that superpower where it lines up with that. And you will be very successful. Now, that doesn't take away from all the support needed around from other leaders and seeing themselves in the work. But I think from a tip, at least that I got, that's been a helpful one is to not ever shy away from that.
One other build to all of this that I would also make is, you know, I think some of us were actually joking about this too, in terms of the tiger moms that we may have had before they were known as tiger moms. And, you know, even just thinking about my own experience, like, I got into a number one liberal arts college and my mom was like, why couldn't you get somewhere better? And it's like, I don't know what to do with that. But I think, you know, part of that, you know, even though I can joke about it now, and I think we all have those experiences, like you get an A, why can't it be higher? That sometimes that, like, you know, we carry that with us. And I think, you know, my main advice, especially for those who may have come up with those types of moms or parents, is own your confidence and really kind of, you know, you're doing great. And really kind of own that development. And I think even just like the question, like what's being done, I would actually flip it and said, what are you doing? What can you all do to really own that and kind of trailblaze? Because I think, you know, we've all talked about this is a multi-generational bet. We're going to make as much progress as we can. But then it is like, you know, what will that look like in 20 years? I have no idea, you know, and my hope is that it's going to look really different. And that these challenges may not go away in its entirety, but there'll be a new set of challenges that we'll all need to figure out and tackle.
Yeah, I'll just say a lot of questions that I've seen come in so far have been, what are some tangible structural things that you've experienced or you're doing to, right, like help all of what we've been talking about? Just from my perspective, the reason this might feel a little squishy to you is, I think, because we're all going through a very transitional period. We all as people, we all as leaders are realizing what and how we've been living with. And for me personally, I've definitely experienced everything that you've just talked about of like living a part of my life, just trying to fit in. Like, what are the management skills and tools that I crafted to just like fit in so I can move up or belong or get stuff done. Now to, it's like a whole other thing, just trying to undo and unlearn those habits so I can be like, you know what? this is me. Like, you take it or leave it, and I'm going to get stuff done, and you will have a seat at the table for me because I can be all of these things. People are not one thing. And so I think to everything what everyone said here, the reason I think we keep coming back to people is that's one thing you can count on, both for intangible and tangible stuff. Tangibly, those are the people who open doors for me, people who spot opportunities before they exist, people who look at things and realize that there may be a fit between what I can bring to the table versus what they might need to solve for. And that includes a lot of people, not just other Asian Americans, but like white men in powerful jobs. And I've definitely had really good mentors and people who've pulled me up to their tables, and that's why I'm here. But the other reason people, I think, is really important to us in intangible ways is because they validate my experience. They give me the strength and the courage to be at a place like this, to share all these things that I feel really uncomfortable talking about, because you make it okay that, yeah, like what you went through, what you experienced, what you're feeling is valid. So I'm really fortunate to have found this community more recently, and people who've always been there for me to kind of remind through thick and thin, like really, like what anchors you, who are you, and always being able to come back to that.
I love the swagger, Minjay. Anybody else? We have a few other questions. I don't think we'll be able to get to them, but we promise we'll get. Sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to just share something that somebody told me once, which actually I think is very related to a things that, you know, people just said, which is like amazing. But that you're more likely to be successful in your career by doing more of what you're good at and not trying to fix all the things that people tell you you're bad at. And I think that that's like actually something that I have like 20/20 hindsight. I can look back and be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But it's something that I just wanted to throw out there for anybody who's earlier in their career.
Anyone else? Any other wisdom that you want to share before we actually close the session? This last chance. Guys, 3, 2, 1. So for the attendees, we will not be able to get to all the questions, but we promise that we'll post our answers. I think that Nadine and Heidi and Cole, you guys know where to post, but we'll promise we'll get back to you guys. In closing, on behalf of the entire panel, I would say a few things. One, again, I'm summarizing today's panel discussion. Seizing this moment in a productive way requires a rational and systematic approach, and also bold steps, bold actions versus emotionally raw conversation alone. The most important question is, how do we keep the momentum? It is not the issue now we're facing. How do we keep this going? How do we keep the intensity we feel around this to make longer term change? If we as business leaders are willing to put so much time and effort into standard business initiatives, then we need to be willing to make an even longer and bolder commitment to equality and equity. This is really our moment. This is our historical moment. And together, only by together, we can be stronger. So thank you to all the panelists for your reflection on social and racial justice and equity. This is timely, insightful, and actionable. And thank you for everyone who called in today. I'm so touched. I'm truly touched. You know, I also shared some, you know, my experiences, which I have never shared before. But your leadership and your empathy and love, let's keep that momentum going. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, I would love your help in sharing CMO Moves with one of your friends or colleagues who you think might enjoy it too. And if you have time, I would really love your review or ratings on Apple or SoundCloud. So thanks again and have a great day.